U.S. businesses thrive on Alibaba's online marketplace, where sales by American companies to Chinese consumers added $53 billion to the U.S. economy in 2022. Discover more at AlibabaPowersBusinesses.com.
From the opinion pages of the Wall Street Journal, this is Potomac Watch.
Bernie Sanders becomes the focus of his competitors as he takes a commanding position in the fight to become the Democratic presidential nominee. Where are the attacks coming from his fellow Democrats? And how vulnerable is he as he enters the week before the South Carolina primary? Welcome. I'm Paul Gigot with my esteemed colleagues. Kim Strassel, how are you? Kim,
hi,
how are
Paul.
You? And Bill McGurn.
Hey, Paul.
Well, let's talk about Bernie Sanders. It's interesting, since the Saturday victory by Bernie Sanders, commanding victory in the Nevada caucuses, it has slowly dawned on people, Democrats in particular, that Bernie Sanders is going to be very hard to stop on his way to the nomination. He has closed the gap with Joe Biden in South Carolina, which will comes this Saturday. It's now, I think, 5 points or so. Biden still leads, but Bernie gaining. The other, Tom Steyer, the billionaire, other billionaire, is third in South Carolina after having spent tens of millions at the very least on his campaign there. And then 3 days later, after South Carolina, we have Super Tuesday, a week from Tuesday. And Bernie is set to do very well in California, the biggest delegate prize, and in many of the other 14 states. So I guess this debate on Tuesday evening will be a real test with Bernie in the dock and everybody going after him. I think they have to, Kim, if they're going to slow him down.
They have to, because, by the way, this is way too little and potentially too late. All these people are saying, wow, how did we end up with Bernie? And my question is, wow, how did you not see this coming when none of you would lay a glove on him all along? So he will be the focus of tonight's debate, much to Michael Bloomberg's delight, although Berg will probably take a bunch of incoming as well, too. And you see the candidates, his rivals, all picking their spots where they're hitting them. You've had Mike Bloomberg going after him on guns, weirdly saying that Bernie is not tough enough on guns. This is the one issue from Bernie's past where he did come from the state of Vermont that had looser gun restrictions, and he has now changed on that. He's become much more pro-gun control. But you have Bloomberg hitting him there. You have Biden hitting him on his the math of his plans, saying that you're not being honest and that you're going to end up raising taxes on the middle class. And you have Buttigieg saying that he is too ideological, too inflexible, that he leaves too many people of the party out. We'll see if any of those resonate and how Bernie responds tonight.
The one of the puzzlements here for me, Bill, is the Bloomberg attack on Bernie for his gun positions. I understand he was previously he said he was a supporter of gun rights for years in Vermont, representing Vermont, which is a gun rights state traditionally. But now he's changed, and he changes in that Sanders way, which is very definitively. I mean, I saw him at the town hall on CNN on Monday night, and he sounded as if he's as ardent as any gun controller in the short of Beto O'Rourke wanting to ban, confiscate all weapons. But he does want to ban assault weapons. He does want all of the list of extensive background checks, close the so-called gun show loophole, other things that is on the agenda of all of the gun controllers. So I don't know how that's going to peel off Democratic voters when Bernie is so emphatic himself.
I agree, because I believe him. I believe that he was always for this, but he just, the reality was he couldn't do it in much the same
because
way,
of Vermont politics.
Vermont politics. And so he voted to not scare the gun owners as a price of keeping his seat and so forth. But it's a lot like Barack Obama on same-sex marriage. Did anyone believe he was really opposed to it? No. And then later he was able to
right.
to take the position that he probably always took on the issue. So I agree with you. I don't see how that hurts him. Plus, he's so emphatic about what he does. And it's hard to doubt. it doesn't have the aura of people switching conveniently on an issue. It, you know, I'm not a gun owner, but if I were, I would believe Bernie's coming for my AR-15.
Well, and yeah, the Bernie is a conviction politician, Kim. I mean, when he says something, part of his appeal, a large part of his appeal, is that people believe him. And so when he makes a change, even if he makes a change on policy, you think, okay, he's going to be there with me. And that's a huge advantage in as a deflection, ability to deflect against attacks.
Right. And it's why what these rivals need to do is to be going after that conviction and pointing out where it leads. I mean, this is the mind-boggling aspect of Bloomberg's decision to go after him of guns. You go after guns of all things. I mean, go after him on the fact that he's going to put a ban on fracking and put a million people out of work. You know, go after him on Medicare and point out that you're going to saddle the country with basically everyone getting a government-run Medicaid-like plan. Go after him on the minimum wage and what that would do to the economy and younger minority workers who would be the ones priced out of the market. There's a lot of places. I mean, the problem with Bernie, the scary thing about Bernie is that conviction and the seeming inability to understand where that leads in the economy and the terrible damage it would do. That's where these candidates need to be hitting him. But they're so scared of offending his progressive base, nobody's willing to do it.
What about the comments that Bernie Sanders made on 60 Minutes, in which he was confronted with a comment from the 1980s that he had made on tape, sympathetic to the Cuban Revolution, where he had talked about the provisions of health care and the other improvements in life, totally transformed society in Cuba, I think was the direct quote. And Anderson Cooper, the correspondent, put it to him to respond. And Bernie Sanders said, well, we oppose authoritarianism. You can't apologize for that. But, you know, when they came in, they did really spread literacy around the country. And Cooper said, but, you know, they have a lot of political prisoners there. And Bernie said, well, but they also did all these other good things for the Cuban people. And Bloomberg and Biden have both gone after him in a big way. How much of a vulnerability is that? Because Bernie seems not to think so, because he turned around at the town hall on Monday night and said, I'm standing by it every step of the way.
Well, I'd say a couple things. One is, I think what Bernie said, that there's actually a large group of left-wingers who believe the same thing. I don't think he's an aberration in that sense. You know, it's the way that Castro has never been treated in the left as the moral monster that he really was, and the ruthless authoritarian. It's sort of this romantic version. So that's one. Second, I think his comments were appalling, but outside of maybe Florida, with some of the Cuban-American community, the votes, I'm not sure it plays, because I'm not sure. My kids, you know, are in their 20s. I think they vaguely have a memory of who Fidel Castro was and so forth. It does seem like an older kind of battle.
So you don't think it's Kim? What do you think?
I slightly disagree with that, only because one thing that is notable is, given South America's, Central America's left-wing lurch over recent decades, that we have a lot of people in this country now that are there beyond the Cubans, beyond Castro, who have fled some sort of socialist dictator, or, you know, Venezuelans fleeing Nicolas Maduro, Nicaraguans fleeing Daniel Ortega, Bolivians fleeing Evo Morales. I think that there's a big, important constituency here for whom that matters directly and could matter on voting day. But as a broader issue, it's a big opening for his competitors, and that includes Republicans, to point out Bernie's the illogical aspect of this. So essentially what he's saying, and we pointed this out in an editorial, is you need basically what, death camps and authoritarian leaders to give people literacy? There are plenty of
good
countries in the world that have provided literacy to their people without all of the horribleness that comes with authoritarian regimes. And one of Bernie's problems is he seems incapable of understanding that true socialism and authoritarianism, that you can't separate them. They go hand in hand. And that's something that I think is a very compelling message for people out there that are opposed to him.
They may be in prison, but political prisoners, but they can read.
They can read. And they've got access to good universal health care.
we're talking about Bernie Sanders and the Democratic primary race, and you're listening to Potomac Watch from The Wall Street Journal.
U.S. businesses thrive on Alibaba's online marketplace, where sales by American companies to Chinese consumers added $53 billion to the U.S. economy in 2022. Discover more at AlibabaPowersBusinesses.com.
From the opinion pages of The Wall Street Journal, this is Potomac Watch.
Welcome back. I'm Paul Gigot with Bill McGurn and Kim Strassel. And I want to keep going on the Cuba comments because I think they're revealing about Bernie Sanders in a way that other things perhaps are not, like the gun control criticism. And I think what this is, what this reveals, and the fact that he's willing to stick with it, is that Bernie Sanders is an authentic man of the left. And by when I say that, I mean that he takes positions that are on the that have been on the well to the left of the mainstream of the American political system for a very, very long time. Now, many of those positions have moved into the mainstream, certainly of the Democratic Party. But this sympathy for left-wing revolutions around the world, whether it be Cuba, whether it be Nicaragua,
Soviet Union,
and Yanimund in the Soviet Union. That's right. There is a kind of a you know, it's the old international solidarity of the left, and Bernie was there. Bernie is there, and I think you see in that sort of that refusal to thoroughly and critically take, you know, attack the Cuban Revolution, that nostalgia for left-wing solidarity and left-wing revolutions.
Yeah, I agree. I think this is where it's more vulnerable. Again, I'm not sure the Castro thing resonates outside the Cuban community as much like in other, for other Latinos. But I think it's of a piece with his softness for authoritarianism. And let's face it, why shouldn't he have a – he has an authoritarian agenda himself on health care and so forth. And I think he likes these command – economies where the government can just do what they think is good for other people. And it's the same kind of philosophy.
It fits with the line he has taken on Venezuela, for example. Now, and it differs with Elizabeth Warren in a very interesting fashion. Bernie he was certainly critical of the authoritarian elements of Nicolas Maduro, the dictator in Venezuela. But he aimed his most vociferous criticism about the United States and Trump policy and the danger of a potential invasion, whereas Elizabeth Warren, you know, focused on the depredations of the regime, and so did most Democrats. But Bernie, you know, is of a little different nature on foreign policy.
Oh, yeah. And this has been a very important distinction between the two of them, of those two candidates, and him and the rest of the field. And one, again, as we're talking about the opportunities to go after him and ask him to explain himself, ought to be brought up in this Tuesday night debate. Again, this question about Bernie Sanders not being able to make that distinction. His idea that he can suggest that, well, you can just have good things that happen with socialism and it's a choice whether or not you get authoritarianism that goes with it. It doesn't really work that way. You know, I saw another line of him again from a long time ago, 1985, but he was asked and he was saying how great it was that there were bread lines. He was talking about Nicaragua, and he was saying, you know, because at least the people there can go out and get in line to get their food. In a lot of countries, only the rich people have food and poor people starve, seemingly oblivious to the fact that it was the system that created the bread lines. And in fact, it was the head of the Nicaraguan regime that, you know, did have all the food and nobody else had it as a result of the system that had been set up. These are a lot of things that people could be pointing out and the flaws in this mentality and what it bodes for this country and policies were he in charge, but they're going to have to take up that challenge.
So, Bill, you and Kim have both been very critical of Michael Bloomberg's strategy going into the race, and the fact that particularly that debate last week where he spent the first hour playing defense on all kinds of identity politics issues, went a little bit on offense, but not sufficiently in my view, and I guess your view as well, on some of the economic issues. If you were advising Bloomberg on how to go after Sanders, what would be your bits of advice going after Sanders now?
Yeah, well, I would do what we've said. I think that I would attack Bernie Sanders' plan, and I would base it on my strength as the mayor of the largest city in the country, you know, larger than 40 states, where he turned a deficit, like a $2.5 billion deficit, into like a $5 billion surplus, and make clear, I support all these proposals that you do. I want a greener earth. I want less fossil fuels.
In general,
as this. But I know in the real world, you have to pay for these things, right? You can't just wish them. And I think he has a strong case if he would press it. But he's not pressing that case. And it just baffles me. And I think he should also make a case for business in the private sector. Say, what happened to this party if we're going to treat people who succeed and create jobs and wealth and opportunity, the wealth that we need for the taxes that we need to pay for, if we treat them as the moral equivalent of heroin dealers? I mean, Bernie can't seem to say the word profit without obscene before it and so forth. And I think he's in a place to do it. He attacked Bernie a little in the grander scheme, the socialism and so forth, and personally saying, you know, he had three houses. But he should really get cut to the heart of that vision. Say, look, I share the larger goals of this party, but I'm a guy that proved I can do it in a practical way.
You share that view, Kim?
Yeah, I agree with that. But I think what he also has to do is somebody on that stage, Bloomberg, and he's the best position to do it, has got to dive into this, the Bernie fantasy land, where Bernie just has all of these things that sound lovely, right? Like, I'm going to give you free everything. Well, somebody has to go up there and talk about what that actually means in reality. And just to give an example, and we mentioned it earlier, but Bernie says, you know, Medicare for all. I want everyone to have free healthcare. It's a human right. Okay, well, go up there and say what that means in reality is there's no such thing as free. You're going to take good health care away from a bunch of people in order to give very bad health care to a lot of people. And there's going to be waiting lines, and there's going to be a poorer standard of health in the country. This is the plan he's talking about. If someone isn't going to take the time to translate the Bernie vision into hard reality, he gets a free pass.
And I think they have to speak in moral terms about these issues, in human terms, not just technocratic terms where you have talk about the fiscal side of it, which is a decent point. But if you're going to talk about healthcare, for example, you have to say, well, Bernie says it's a right, but then he is saying to you, 250 million Americans and everybody now on Medicare, that your plan is going away, and I'm going to give you one plan. Is that a moral decision? I'm going to write off the loans of the people who didn't have the personal responsibility to repay them. The people who did repay them, sorry, you're out of luck. Is that a moral decision? Is that a moral judgment? Right. I'm going to take away a million or so jobs that are devoted to oil and gas drilling. What about their livelihoods? Is that a moral decision? Right. In favor of some, you know, solar future that may or may not appear? And you have to go in those terms. And the Democrats don't have that language.
None of them.
Their vocabulary.
The problem is most of them, if they're not Bernie, they're Bernie light. They share all these assumptions. He's just taken them to the natural conclusions. And unfortunately, there's that authoritarian streak in Mike Bloomberg, too. You know, he wants to decide what sodas you're going to have and smoking and so forth. So he's a little handicapped. But I agree, if he just used the word moral to talk about these choices between what Bernie proposes and what he would do, it would really focus attention on the human effects, the people, the families who really will bear the effect of the aftershocks.
Kim, what do you think about Donald Trump's tweeting so actively in the Democratic primary race, basically congratulating Bernie, saying, you know, they're going to take it away from you again, Bernie. That means the Democrats. He obviously thinks he can stir up some trouble, intra-Democratic trouble here if the Democrats do try to block Sanders at the convention. Or he's also maybe thinks that Sanders is the best, easiest choice for the candidate to run against. But I'm not so sure at this stage that that's shrewd. I mean, he may be actually giving Democrats an argument, some of them to say, well, if maybe Sanders has something going for him, maybe he's a stronger candidate than we think. And if Sanders does win the nomination, it may have been a bad play.
Yeah, I mean, the question, as it always is with Donald Trump, is why he feels the need to, quote, stir up trouble, as you put it, when Democrats are doing such a good job of it themselves. I mean, just sit back and enjoy the show, right? Sometimes there is merit to letting the other side implode in its own way. But I agree with you, too, from a strategic sense. If Bernie starts cruising ahead and no one is in fact denying him this bid, how do these tweets actually help Donald Trump in the end? I mean, if he's going to feel the need to somehow comment on the race, talk about some of the things we've been talking about. And by the way, do it. This is my concern about an ultimate Bernie Sanders bid against a Donald Trump, is we've been talking about the need to dissect some of these Bernie policies. I'm not sure Donald Trump is the guy who's going to do that in a really sophisticated way, because he just seems instead to want to run around calling him Crazy Bernie without getting into any of the details or the problems of these policies.
Yeah, it seems to me that, and it's early. I mean, obviously, Bernie Sanders doesn't even have the nomination yet. But once he becomes the clear likely nominee, then I think the Republicans and Donald Trump are going to have to make a much more focused, much more disciplined assault on his agenda and what he would do. Bill, briefly.
Yeah, I agree entirely. But of course, that's true of any of the candidates. Right. I mean, right now we don't know who the...
But Sanders is more formidable than Trump thinks, in my view.
He may be. He may be. I think if Bloomberg did it properly, he might be. But there's a case for all of them now.
Yeah. All right. Thank you, Bill. Thank you, Kim. Thank you all for listening. We will be back tomorrow with another edition of Potomac Watch.
U.S. businesses thrive on Alibaba's online marketplace, where sales by American companies to Chinese consumers added $53 billion to the U.S. economy in 2022. Discover more at alibabapowersbusinesses.com.